And we are back here at radio.dominican.edu. It's the Temple of Swan. I'm Alex Swan. Alongside with me is Mike Temple. And today, for our show, we're going to have Noel Roldan and Jade Castro join us to be interviewed on the second back half hour of this show. But we're going to start it with A's and Giants baseball talk. We'll get into Josh Hamilton's slide. Is it worth sliding into first base? Kentucky's program living off the one and done. What's that doing for college basketball with the one and done rule? And 49ers, what in the world is going on with Kaepernick and among others with this sexual assault investigation? All next on the Temple of Swan.
Welcome back to the Temple of Swan for our eighth edition of this semester. We're wrapping up pretty quickly here. Swan, I just want to get your feelings on what school's like going towards this last month. What are you feeling?
One class has been stressing me out, research methods. Other than that, I'm excited for the end of the year, but it's flown by this first year, I think, between us two. This is our first year here, and I'm honestly glad to say I'm not a senior. One more year, I think we'll do me good. I think we'll do us both pretty good. What do you think? How's the year been going?
Yeah, I agree. I'm glad it's almost over. Like you said, we're almost to summer, though. And then you got one more year of school until we are in the real world.
Yeah. I wonder what the seniors are thinking like right now.
Well, the ones that we've had on the show have been pretty panicked because they don't really know what they're going to do. So yeah. I feel like that's just the natural occurrence.
I really hope we're not feeling that type of feeling. Agreed. But who knows?
Agreed. Let's get into some baseball talk, something that we do know a little bit of about. We're going to start with the A's, since they did just play today. Swept the Twins.
Break out the broom.
And which they seem to do against the Twins a lot. It's their eighth straight win at Target Field. They won 6-1. They won 6-1 today, and they seem to swing the bat very well there in a very spacious park. What's your feelings on the A's starting off the season now 6-3?
I think they're okay, they're fine. They lead the AL in ERA, so they're looking good. Despite the Jim Johnson blunders, and we'll get into that in a few moments about what Melvin has announced with Jim Johnson, I think A's are fine. I love to see them take care of business, get the sweep at Target Field. That's a team that they should beat, and they took care of business, and they did. Donaldson going yard today. And despite some struggles from Cespedes and Reddick, I think A's, they look good top to bottom. What are you thinking?
Yeah, and Cespedes is struggling, but he's getting those clutch hits.
Yeah.
Which he always seems to do. He'll come up with their down one when they need a homer. Cespedes will knock one out for you, and that'll be his only hit of the game, but he'll provide that usual clutch hit. On the other hand, like you said, Reddick has been really the only blemish, I think, to the start. Well, and Jim Johnson, but that's the known one. Reddick strikes out way too much. He's not making contact. And he's playing for a roster spot right now because Craig Gentry's coming off the DL and will be activated this week, maybe for this next series against the Mariners. So who do you drop down? Do you drop down Sam Fold, who just homered today?
I don't.
And who's playing really well? Do you drop down Barton and lose an extra first baseman and you run five outfielders? Huge questions, and Reddick might be the guy that they send down.
That would make the most sense to me, even though player-wise, I'd value him over Barton. But I don't think you can run five outfielders if you're Melvin. So the way Sam Fold is playing, if you optioned him, he's going to get picked up off of waivers. You can't do that. I say you keep him where he's at. He's hot. And it's early for Reddick to go find his swing since he just was cooking over spring training. But that seems like right now the most logical option to me with Gentry upon return. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm thinking the same thing. I mean, you can't really have five outfielders and only one first baseman. Well, and Kiaspa would be the second baseman if they send Barton down. So I don't think that's the guy they send down. even though all the A's fans probably want Derek Barton down because he seems to be the A's least favorite player.
Explain to me why Barton gets booed so much.
He's the longest tenured Athletic, and he's been up and down the majors, down to the River Cats. He cost the A's a game last year in the playoffs. I mean, he always seems to just be in the wrong spot at the wrong time.
Okay.
I mean, he's just none of the fans like him at Oakland. I mean, he's not your prototypical first baseman. He likes to walk. He's a contact hitter, plays great defense, but he's not that power guy that you see like Brandon Moss. He's not going to hit those skyscraping home runs, those huge doubles in the gap. Barton's going to walk instead. He's going to try to get on base with the walk. I mean, I don't mind Barton that much, and I've always rooted for him. And I don't think it's his time to go back down to the minors because he would once again have to clear waivers. But he has a better chance of clearing waivers than Sam Fold. If you send Sam Fold down to the minors, which you really can't because he has no options left down in the minors, so we'd have to clear waivers. You know every team's going to want to put a claim in for him. The way he's playing on defense, he's already made two web gems. He's hit a home run. He has two triples, I think. Yeah, two triples on the season. You can't send down Sam Fold. So
get claimed.
What's that leave us with? You got to send down Josh Reddick. Like you said, it's still early enough. He has an option left, so he won't have to clear waivers. Go down to AAA, work on your swing, and start seeing the ball a little bit better. But he's just striking out way too much to be on a major league roster, even with his great defense.
I agree. So when Reddick does find his swing, what could be the plan of attack?
Then,
yeah. You just keep riding the hot hand, this kind of plethora
and I think it'll
cycle
play,
of
yeah,
outfielders?
I think it'll play itself out, though, as well. Because the A's are very injury, I don't know what's, they're injury, like they get a lot of injuries. Let's just say that. I want to say injury prone, but that would work. Yeah.
I think so.
Anyways,
yeah.
Let's just work with that. Okay, so Coco Crisp already had to have a cortisone shot. He always seems to be in and out of injury DL time. Then you got Craig Gentry just coming off an injury. Cespedes is always one extra base hit away from pulling a groin. I mean, just the way the A's outfield shapes, they have a lot of good outfielders, but it'll play itself out to where you just got to make the move now and keep riding those hot hands because Sam Fold is playing too well right now to just drop him.
I agree. So there's decision one. Decision two has already been made by the skipper. Jim Johnson is no longer the closer.
Yeah, it was a matter of time before that happened. After the second one, I was like, okay, we still need it. Because I remember we were on the show last week when he blew, I think it was at that time he blew two saves. And I was like, okay, let's all be calm. Let's just keep him in for one more. He'll get himself. He'll find himself. But after that third one, you're up two against the Twins going in the last inning, and you can't get even two outs. You only got one out in that game, and Otero had to come in and save the duty. It was about time. You can only ride him so long before you just give up. I mean, and that's not saying he's not going to get the closer role back in 2 months or something. It's just right now he's not pitching well enough to be the closer, the guy you're looking to lock down a game in the ninth inning.
And he can't do that right now. And so Melvin decides to go with closer by committee. Which player do you think emerges out of this group of Gregerson, Doolittle, and Cook, or possibly Otero?
And the A's do have a lot of good arms in the back end of their bullpen. Like you said, Doolittle, Gregerson, Otero, Cook. Those are four guys who I think are capable of all pitching the ninth inning, which is why Melvin, I believe, is going with the safe call and saying we'll do it by committee in matchups. I don't like Doolittle in the closer's role. He gives up a little too many home runs for my liking. You see, almost every run that Doolittle gives up is a home run, like he did 2 days ago against the Twins. He gave up another solo shot. I don't like him as a closer. He's more of just a prototypical one-inning setup guy. Gregerson, never been a closer before. He's been a permanent setup man, so I don't know if he's the one to go to, even though he's filthy.
He's very filthy, Gregerson. So I could see him getting at least a couple outs, an out or two in the ninth, is the start of this carousel starts in the closer committee.
Yeah, and then you go to Otero, who closed some in AAA, and he pitched very well for the down the stretch for the A's last year. I think he's capable of closing, but I think all in all, they're going to go back to their closer of beginning of last year, Ryan Cook. He lost his duty. He was an all-star in 2012, lost his closer role. But he's been up and down from being closer, setup man. So I think Ryan Cook has the best chance of, all in all, winning that so-called closer role. I think he's the guy you go to. He just came off the deal, and he's pitched two innings already, shut out. I think he's the guy.
He'll need a little time to get back in the swing of things, but no shame in going to the closer of committee.
Yeah.
Johnson just wasn't, he just didn't have the stuff.
Yeah, and he wasn't commanding his fastball, which is like huge for him because he's not a strikeout pitcher. He likes to rely on that ground ball. And if you're not controlling your fastball and you're putting guys on base in the ninth inning, anything can happen. The Twins, let's take the last game, for example. You're up 2, gives up a leadoff single. Okay, you'll take that, even though he was down 3-1 in the count. I mean, okay, whatever. Next batter walks, then he gives up another single. You can't, without getting an out, all this is happening without getting an out. Jim Johnson just wasn't commanding his fastball, getting behind in the count. And that's why he has an 18 ERA after 4 appearances.
What does this mean for Jim Johnson? What kind of role does he move into now?
And Jim Johnson, from everything that's been said about him and all the press,
he's
handling it well.
That himself, he really wants to do well for this team.
Yeah, and he's of course taking all the blame. Like he said, he was the reason why they've lost 2 games already. I mean, he's taking all the blame, which is what you want to see. But I don't know where his role is. We've already talked about Otero, Doolittle, and Cook, and how good they are at the back end. Maybe Jim Johnson's a 6th inning guy now. I mean, I don't know where I see him I don't know where I picture him pitching anymore because of how poorly he's thrown in the last couple of games.
So if he gets lost a little bit in the bullpen, will that do him good?
Yeah,
maybe if he just doesn't have some appearances, maybe he just gets his mind right.
And he's getting out of the pressure situations of the 9th inning. Maybe some fans will start to like him once he starts getting shutout innings, because pitching in the 6th is much pitching in the 6th up by 1, let's say, is a lot different than pitching in the 9th up by 1.
Of course.
And maybe that gets him on the right foot, and then if you keep seeing maybe 6 or 7 straight outings where he's posting zeros, then maybe you can get the switch.
I agree. And so, talk about the A's offense a little bit. They got it going at Target Field. Like you said, they won 8 straight. Doing it kind of how they started with doing it last year. A little bit of long ball, a little bit of the clutch hitting. We saw D-Nor come up, pinch hit, 3-run bomb to bail out. The blown save. We were talking about that in class quickly about the blown save, how Johnson didn't get that blown save.
Yeah, that's
it. It was charged to Otero.
That's an interesting rule. It's whoever's pitching at the time when that
tying
run is scored.
That.
Yeah, when the tying run is scored. So it doesn't matter if Jim Johnson was the one to get that guy on base. Whoever is pitching when that tying run is scored gets a blown save, which is kind of unfair to Dan Otero, who got the A's out of a jam.
Exactly.
But he gets charged for the blown save. I don't think he really cares because the A's won, but that was interesting to find out.
D-Nor comes up clutch. How do you feel the A's going into the next series?
They are taking on the Mariners, and which means King Felix pitching game 1 against Tommy Malone. I don't know about our chances in that one, to be completely honest. But the Mariners are a very good team. The A's, I think, are a better team, and they're showing that right now. If they hit the ball the way they are, they're hitting it out of the park like they did 2 years ago. Brandon Moss is getting double after double. He's not striking out as much. Josh Donaldson, like you said today, already hit a homer and a double. Jed Lowry's swinging the bat well. If we can get all these guys to piece it together, the A's are going to be a very dangerous team. And like you said in the opening, the A's have the leading ERA in the ERA in the AL. And that's something that to keep your eye on. If they can keep the Mariners down to 2-3 runs like they did in the last series against them, they should be able to win this series.
So is it just going to be, again, a two-team race here, Texas and Oakland fighting for the AL West? Because we'll get into the Hamilton injury later, but Angels are struggling, and now they lose Hamilton. Mariners, you don't know how long they could ride these hot bats for the youngins, I'll call them. And then I'm not going to disrespect the Astros, but
yeah,
they'll taper out.
They've already started to taper out.
Is it a two-team race again?
Yeah,
and Texas doesn't even look – they'll get going. They don't look like the team that we all thought they were.
Texas is dealing with injuries just like the Oakland A's are, and they haven't been able to handle them as well because they aren't deep enough. Like, the A's will go 4 or 5 deep at a position, and their AAA team will be pretty stocked. The Rangers, on the other hand, are front-loaded with their guys being their guys. When Profar went down, they have no one really to take his place, and that's really hurting the Rangers right now, and they have no starting rotation. Darvish has been scratched one time. I mean, it's just bouncing back and forth with the Rangers. I see the Rangers, Mariners, and A's being in a tight battle, but I do see the Mariners falling out late, and I think it's going to be the Rangers and A's down the stretch. When the Rangers get healthy, they're going to make a nice little run to pressure the A's. So I think it comes down to those two teams.
Angels are in trouble again.
Yeah, the Josh Hamilton injury, I think, hurts them and puts them out of contention.
That's big.
They had to call up J.B. Shuck. So now they're running an outfield of J.B. Shuck, Cole Calhoun, and Trout, when it looked much better with Cole Calhoun, Josh Hamilton, and Mike Trout.
Absolutely.
Hamilton was starting off the season on fire as well. So, I mean, that really hurts them and I think takes them out of the race. I mean, you can never say that about one team, but so early on in the season, but
that hurts.
I can't picture
especially
them.
Especially if surgery's in the foreseeable future for Josh Hamilton.
And the way he did it, too, that's got to frustrate the Angel fans.
And the manager and Hamilton.
Do you have any take on what he did? I mean, you can explain it to the listeners who weren't watching.
We were watching this game, Temple and I, and Hamilton was trying to beat out a ground ball, and he slid into first, and he led with his left hand. It seems like the predominant hand you kind of lead with when you slide. Puig slid into first, leading with his right hand, completely jammed up his thumb. Puig's slide looked a lot worse than Hamilton's slide, because Hamilton popped up. He hit the bag, but his hand hit it, kind of thumped, and then it carried over. It didn't get caught. Nothing got caught. And he was able to get up, walked off. Okay. But when he did that, the announcers lost it, because they automatically speculated injury. He looked fine, and they said, oh, what a risk that could have been for Hamilton.
Especially a guy like Josh Hamilton.
Yeah. And so I thought, okay, no injury. That's a good point by the commentators. Next thing you know, he's got a torn, what, UCL?
Yeah, in his wrist.
In his wrist. And so surgery likely out 6 to 8 weeks for a ground ball he tried to beat out that he didn't even make, sliding into first. Is it worth it? We see runners kind of do it more often, and some runners do it more gracefully than others, but is this going to be a theme to where coaches say, okay, we're done. We're done sliding at first.
Yeah, and usually the only players who will slide at first are those scrappy guys like a Nick Punto, or like for the Giants, maybe a Joaquin Arias, someone who's a utility guy just trying to hang on to the roster and let everyone know he's the scrapper. He's going to make sure that he's making his presence known by getting dirty. Now, a guy like Josh Hamilton, who bats third or fourth in your lineup on any given day, you cannot do that. Like you said, he wasn't even safe. And I think sliding at first even makes you a slower. Like, it makes you gives you more of a chance of getting out.
Sports Science did a time on that, and you're correct. It is a slight slower.
So I don't know why people keep doing it, and it's so dangerous. As we see, so many injuries are happening because they're sliding into first. So Josh Hamilton's now going to have to sit out a while and think about what he just did, causing his team to really now panic and call up J.B. Shuck, who might not be ready for the majors, even though he's bounced up and down a couple times. The Angels are in some trouble, but we'll see how they rebound. I think they still need a lot of pitching help with Weaver not being so solid. They're not as deep. So the Rangers and Angels, they're still relying on their hitting with their pitching being so rough. And now the A's just have to keep that pitching staff where it is through the first 9 games of the season.
In the quick tidbit before we hop over to the other side of the bay and get into some of the struggles that went down last night, how stoked do you got to be, not only as an A's fan, but the skipper Melvin? You lose your ace, and throughout the first 9, you lead the league in the ERA.
Yeah, and everyone's stepping up. Jesse Chavez has pitched 2 great games for the A's, and you got Scott Kazmir's also pitched in 2 quality starts. Then Dan Straley, he gave up 2 home runs in his first start. This time only gives up 1 and 3 hits.
Down.
So, I mean, everyone's stepping up and filling the role, and that's why the A's had so many arms to begin with. And they're pitching without their best pitcher, Jared Parker, and they're pitching without probably their number 3 or 4 guy, A.J. Griffin, and they're still posting the best ERA through 9 games. You've got to like what you see. You've
got to
like what you see.
We'll go over to Timmy for the Giants, as this was the year where everybody thought Timmy would return, but he would be a different pitcher. He no longer was going to rely on his fastball. He was taking it all out. He wanted to develop a more of a Tim Hudson type delivery, and location, location, location became a huge point for Timmy. First outing looked okay. Goldschmidt got to him.
Yeah.
So everyone was like, okay, Timmy, you give up 4. Not the best. We were hoping to see more, but you had only give up two through nearly 6 innings until the bomb. Last night was first home opener for Timmy. Everybody's looking for a nice bounce back, trying to get revenge on the D-backs that got him his first loss in his opening start. And boom, right in the first inning, Goldschmidt goes oppo, 3-run bomb. Ownage is ownage, as you hear it all the time in baseball. And Timmy got rocked.
Yeah, I was talking to someone, you know Jordan. I was talking to Jordan, and he was giving me a stat about Tim Lincecum versus Paul Goldschmidt. And he said, 7 home runs and 24 at-bats Paul Goldschmidt has off Tim Lincecum. And then he was listing off this name of like 15 all-stars who have combined in 150 at-bats to only hit 7 homers off Tim Lincecum. I thought it was such an interesting thing. That he was like, it was names like Matt Kemp, Andre Ethier, just guys that, I mean, you could just keep naming them. I forgot all the names, and I should have had them, but it was guys who have just been all-star after all-star every year, and then you get Paul Goldschmidt, only 24 at-bats, 7 home runs.
He's dialed.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of strange because they did in the Chronicle Live, they're doing a simulation between Goldschmidt and Posey's swing, and it's very similar how they hold the bat, how they stand, how they do their a quick tap before they release and fire in the hole. I was like, wow, that Goldschmidt is a great hitter, and he went oppo. There was some stat, like 16 home runs have only been hit out of AT&T to right field by right-handed hitters, and Goldschmidt was another one. And so we go into the Timmy struggles. This looks like the same old Timmy.
Yeah.
Is he going to be kind of, I don't know, running out of gas as his career comes, I don't want to say to a halt,
yeah,
but
he's
not
going to
find
yeah.
a job pitching in the top three of a rotation if he continues this.
It's going to be interesting to see how long Bochy and the staff hold on to Tim Lincecum in that starting rotation. I mean, I say you give him 10 starts, but
absolutely,
there's got to be a time when you say, okay, Timmy, we like you out of the bullpen. That's where you're going to give us the most help.
That might have to be the solution.
Because Tim Lincecum, every start, he's getting bombed and giving up too many home runs, too many doubles, too many powerful hits to where you can keep him in that 3 or 4 spot that the Giants have him in right now. But the good thing about the Giants pitching rotation is Hudson stepping up. He looks like I don't want to say it too early on, but he looks like an ace. And
he
then
does.
You got Bumgarner pitching very well. And Kaner is so inconsistent right now. But if you have those three guys and they continue the way they are going right now, then I think the Giants will be okay with Tim Lincecum struggling like he is so far.
That would be huge. They do need help with the back end. We'll see how Vogie does tonight, but we'll call him Vogie or Vogel.
Yeah, that's a huge start for him today.
If he doesn't do well, you got three that are capable of getting a win going out when they start, and then you got two that are lagging behind. You need that rotation to kind of collaborate and get going.
Yeah, and Giants want to, of course, win the series against the Diamondbacks. Vogelsong on the hill. They want to bounce back from their first real poor performance of the season, because the Giants, through this first 10 games, we'll say 9, whatever, first 10 games of the season, have looked very strong, both offensively and defensively. They're playing very well, and I like what I've seen from the Giants early.
I agree, and it's been a surprise. They were looking for a left fielder, and Michael Morris has delivered as that power left fielder. Not as much speed as Blanco, but right now they are taking more contact, more power over defense, and you see Bochy make the switch to pull out Michael Morris maybe in the 6th inning if the Giants have the lead for defensive purposes. But the main concern, Timmy and Vogelsong, they got to get it going. That's going to do it for baseball. When we come back, the one-and-done rule in college basketball. That's something Temple and I are going to get into when we get back on radio.dominican.edu. You're listening to the Temple of Swan.
Swim, we're moving in, have faith within on my got a card up my sleeve. Name it and I'll pull it out your ear. I got a rabbit in my hat. If you wanna come and see, this is what we'll be. This is what we'll be. I got shackles on my wrist. Soon I'll slip them and be gone. Chain me in a box in the river. And I sing in this song. Trust none of what you hear.
We are back in the radio lab at radio.dominican.edu. This is the Temple of Swan. We are going to be talking about the one and done rule in college basketball, which seems to be Kentucky's rule. I'll just call it Kentucky's rule because they always seem to have
pretty
five solid freshmen.
Kentucky's rule, yeah.
Since the national championship just happened, Kentucky ran the table, almost got the championship win over Connecticut as an 8 seed. Started all five freshmen, the first time to do that in a national championship game since the Fab Five.
That's what I'm completely baffled by, is they started the five freshmen and they pulled it together all at the right time, nearly won that title. I'm pretty shocked.
Yeah, and they did not look good throughout the season.
Not at all.
I mean, you'd see games where they'd be down 20, not rebounding at all, even though they had all that size with Willie Cauley-Stein. They had so many guys who could just pound you on the boards, and they weren't getting it done. Coach Cal said it was just freshmen being freshmen.
Yeah, that was the main
No one was believing
point.
Him.
Yeah.
Maybe your team's just overrated, and then they come to the tournament as an 8 seed, which is kind of high for a program like Kentucky.
Absolutely.
And they run the table, get to the championship game, and lose a very good game against Connecticut. Went back and forth. Even though they never had the lead, it did go back and forth, and it was within 1 point for most of the second half.
Yeah. What I thought about Kentucky is they came up extremely clutch. Those freshmen, especially the Harrison twins, Andrew Harrison hitting that big three against Michigan, hitting that huge three against Wisconsin. Those are two games they could easily go down. They pull it out. They get into the ship. One thing before we get into the one-and-done rule is, this is what I've noticed about the past championship teams, and we'll compare it to the Connecticut team that won it 2 years ago with Kemba Walker. Kemba had Shabazz as his backcourt running mate, and you see just a dominant point guard who's a leader, who can score, who can hit the three, and then Shabazz won that title. Now he's a senior. Now, then he has Boatwright in the backcourt is his running mate. Something about a dual combo, just complete tandem in a backcourt, wins championships. It's no longer like the dominant big man feed. We haven't seen someone nearly like Patrick Ewing since Georgetown Hoya days anymore. It seems like the dominant duo can get you that ship.
Yeah, and you need a good point guard and an off guard, a shooting guard like Boatwright or Shabazz, whatever, because they were kind of interchangeable. You need those good guards to win a championship. Kentucky really didn't have a good guard. I mean, they had Harrisons who could shoot the outside and really, really dribble, but they weren't point guards.
And you saw what Boatwright and Shabazz did to them, just locked them up.
Caused many turnovers in the backcourt. And I think that's a huge point that you bring up. I think the guards who have experience in big games can really take you a long way. Shabazz and Boatwright hit shot after shot on isolation plays, just really willing their team to the victory. And I think that was a huge point in why UConn was the victor over Kentucky.
I agree. And for a team that nearly got bounced in overtime, and St. Joe's, based off the score, played Connecticut the toughest.
In the first round.
Yeah, in the very first round. And then next thing you know, they throw together and they win a ship under Kevin Ollie, who I think is a phenomenal coach. That's one of the players' coaches who really understands scheme and how to win at the collegiate level, gets the players to play for him. But we'll go to the one and done. Embiid for Kansas is gone. The 7 foot center of the phenomenon. Wiggins is gone.
Jabari,
I'm assuming Jabari gone. And then we have rumors that Julius Randle, the power forward for Kentucky, is gone. Those four names were essentially the top four projected to go in the beginning of the year of the draft. Are all those four athletes ready?
I don't think they're ready for the NBA. You can't.
I agree.
I don't see how you could be ready after 1 year of college basketball. We saw Jabari Parker and Wiggins, how they played in the the NCAA tournament, they looked like the stage was too big for them. And that's the NCAA tournament. It's not an NBA game against elite players. This is against good college point. Players. And I don't think these guys are ready after 1 year. They get so hyped up with everyone saying that they're the best freshman ever. They're the diaper dandies. They're the ones going to go in the top 10 of the draft. They're going to go in the lottery or whatever you call it. I mean, these guys are just getting in their heads that they're already right away because they play for some of the best college teams. The NBA is a different animal than college basketball. We see year after year lottery picks go into the NBA and do nothing. They might get exactly 2 or 3 minutes a game. It's really...
You think they get money hungry?
I think that plays a part in it, and they just want to be famous, and they don't want to spend their time in school when they can jump up to the NBA already and not have to worry about school.
It's almost... It's not a proven fact, but it's nearly a proven kind of point of you see guards, forwards, big men that stay 3 to 4 years and come out and put in work. But then you see the Anthony Davises, Derrick Rose, those guys coming out after 1 year and just dominating. But then you see a guy like Kemba Walker who stayed 4 years dominating. Yeah. And then you see a guy, I don't know, Let's get a point guard who came out early. I'm a Tar Heel fan. Kendall Marshall, went to the Elite Eight, came out with that huge class, had to go to the D League.
Yeah,
and now he's finally found a home with the Lakers. I don't know if there's agents or who that tells these guys you're ready, but there's often more times than not these players aren't.
Yeah,
and it's gonna be a shame if Wiggins and Parker don't pan out, because these guys, if they stayed and developed their game, they could put a guarantee that they would be polished, ready for the NBA in 2 to 3 years.
If they stay even one more year,
yes.
If you can do 2 years of college basketball under coaches like Coach K, under Roy Williams, guys who are just great basketball minds, I don't see how you could get worse. I mean, you can only get better, and you can only grow in experience and maturity to where you're ready for the NBA.
And it's hard to work on your game in the NBA because you're going up against such a great competition. You can't really fine-tune your skills with Tabo Cephalosha in your grill.
Exactly. You don't have those games against mid-majors to where you can start to work on things. You can start to maybe dribble with your left more. In the NBA, if you dribble with your left more, you're getting picked.
You can't experiment with that.
Exactly.
It's exactly.
Because you're getting hounded right away. So, I mean, the one-and-done rule to me needs to be changed. And hopefully will be changed, because you see it in the tournament so many times. Teams who have veterans or guys who stay 2 to 3 years are so much more experienced and well. I mean, they're just better teams in the conference tournaments and in the NCAA tournaments than teams who are all freshmen. I mean, Kentucky was the exception this year because they made some beautiful shots towards the end of the games and they really executed down the stretch. But you don't see that too often.
And those are the top. Those are 5 of the top 10 All-Americans in high school, best players in high school. Coming out, it's an exception in that I will give. That's how good Calipari is as a coach. He's very good. But I'll bring up two teams that what you just said makes this point. North Dakota State, 5 seniors, and I hate to say this, is Mercer, 5 seniors, 7 or 8 seniors on that whole team. There's your whole guys that you build and you played with and you practice and you ran all these plays
with
for 4 years. And then you got a team that's young.
And those kind of teams like Mercer and like North Dakota State, we saw it down the stretch against Oklahoma and Duke. They execute better than Duke and Oklahoma because they've been together for so long. They know where the other guy's going to be in a clutch situation. They know the guys to go to if they need a huge three. Teams that stick together like North Dakota State and like Mercer, That's why they're capable of doing those first round upsets over huge programs. It's because they've stayed together for 4 years. They've been practicing all summer. They've been hitting the gyms together. They're not those guys who are going to do 1 year, get out.
Yeah. So if it's 2 years, what does that mean for college basketball? Does that help the sport if it's 2 years? I feel like it's going to help out at least a little bit more. You're not going to have as many busts. 2 years is a long time to work on a game, especially if you're a high-touted recruit.
I think,
it's good for the fans. Good for the sport.
Yeah, exactly. I think 2 years will help both the NBA and the NCAA. Because if you're holding on to a player, let's say we're holding on to Wiggins and Parker for 2 years, that's another year of growth.
Goodness.
That's another year of growth they're going to have in the NCAA. That's more kind of national attention towards both Duke, Kansas, and college basketball itself. And that's less of a chance they're going to bust or not be as good players in the NBA. And that makes the NBA a better sport in general if they're going to get the best players to come out and everyone's producing.
Agreed.
If that makes sense.
I think it works for both parties. The only thing that is holding this back is players want to make their coin.
Yeah.
So 1 year, it's tempting. I'm good enough. I'm top five. I know I'm going in the top five. See ya. And I'm out.
And that's why so many people, I think, make the jump.
And that's what all these players for Kentucky have been doing. And then Calipari goes, and he has to recruit essentially a whole new five starters. That's why we call it the Kentucky rule.
Yeah.
How long can he keep doing this? And eventually, is this just going to – we've seen coaches keel down with a heart attack from stress. College coaches are recruiting their asses off, excuse me, but nearly a whole year, they have no breaks. I don't know how much longer Calipari can do this.
Yeah.
With this one-and-done rule, having five freshmen and start and then goodbye exactly. to at least four.
And he's really done this the last 3 years, get some of the top freshmen, like multiple, four or five of the top freshmen coming to his school and then leaving after 1 year. Like you said, that puts a lot of stress on him because he has to go out and recruit those guys first off in the offseason and make sure he's pitching them the right way to get them to their program. And then he has to control the guys that do stay.
Exactly. You got to still...
Yeah. And the new players that are coming in, because the guys who are staying for Kentucky are those eighth or ninth guys who don't really get to see the court too much. And now you got to weave them into the star freshmen that are coming in. It's such a hard task, I think, for Coach K and other coaches who are really taking part in this one-and-done rule.
I agree with you. That's good speculation. That's all I've got on it. But we'll see where college basketball goes with this because it's just kind of a recurring theme. But one thing that the sport cannot knock with this one-and-done rule is these freshmen that come in and they dip, they're providing college basketball with excitement. They're still making runs. Kentucky went to the ship. You can't say, okay, these guys aren't NBA ready. They got to the ship.
Yeah.
People may speculate and say, okay, individually wise, you're not ready, which they're probably got a good point, but they got to the ship.
Yeah.
And so agents can say, hey, you're look what you've done. You've played with these four other great players. You can go to the NBA and play.
That's true.
So
that makes a good point. And then kind of wrapping off, since we're kind of done with the one and done rule, something I want to talk about since this is kind of near and dear to your heart. San Francisco Niners have been through some media problems in the last couple of weeks with some of their star players. Do you have any input on what's really going on in the Niners camp right now?
One thing, when you come off a heartbreak loss in the NFC Championship, especially to your bitter rival, is you want to be in grinding throughout the offseason. And you don't want to have any type of rumor. You want to be under the radar. You know when you have that you're kind of sad, you're going to bed, you just want to throw the covers over your head. You don't want anybody to see you until next season. And you'll be ready to roll. That's not the case at all with the Niners. Lost a lot of players via free agency. You got Chris Culliver, who probably just ran himself out of San Francisco when he had a starting job at corner. We won't get into too much of that. I'm assuming our listeners have heard what happened to Culliver. Hit and run. And now, today, we get Colin Kaepernick has been involved in a sexual assault investigation. I have the police report. I'm not going to read it. I don't believe it's appropriate. Should I read it? I don't think I should read it.
I don't.
And so...
Just sum it up.
If you could. I don't even know if I could do that without not... getting radio.dominican.edu in trouble or the show. But if you want to check it out, go to Bleacher Report, and they will have the police report on Colin Kaepernick. And it's not good. Doesn't make Cap look good. Doesn't make Quentin Patton look good, who was involved. And there is a receiver on Seattle, Ricardo Lockett, who was involved also. Doesn't make him look good. But this just adds fuel. This is dumping a huge tank of gas onto the fire right after Culliver made a huge mistake. This isn't a corner, though. This is your captain. This is a guy that wants huge money.
And that's the one
franchise
thing
quarterback.
Exactly. That's the one thing I want to talk about is Kaepernick's looking to get that contract extension, get that huge $18 million deal, and then he's going in the offseason doing things that might get him in trouble. And yes, it's alleged, and yes, it's a report, so we don't really know exactly what happened since it just came out today. But a guy who's looking to make that $18 million contract and is having these rumors surface is not a good thing. I mean, if I'm the Niners organization and I'm looking to sign my star young quarterback, I'm not doing it this year because I still have a year on his contract. Now that I think that the talk should end.
If you're management, I say, okay, you know what, Cap?
We're going to have to wait
another
year.
Why would we want to sign you when we see this? How are you responsible enough that we can carry you on with this massive deal that you are demanding, and you're going to carry yourself like this outside of the field?
So I think in that case, it gives the Niners organization a real strong hand in demanding these contract negotiations. We've been hearing a lot in the offseason saying Kaepernick wants that huge deal and that he's going to get it this year before he has to play for that contract year. But now I think there's no real rush on it. You make Kaepernick earn it. You make him bring you to the Super Bowl, and then you can pay him his $18 million. But until then, you can't put enough trust in this guy to where you're giving him such a huge contract early on.
I agree. And not only does that kind of hinder the contract negotiations, but as a team, this is not the offseason you wanted at all as an organization. I mean, geez.
Coming off an NFC
Trent
champion. Baalke
is scratching his head. You got Jim Harbaugh scratching his head wondering what in the heck is going on to a team that fought so hard wanting to get back to a Super Bowl, and we're handling ourselves like this for an offseason where we're trying to get back.
Yeah, and the Niners lost a lot of key players. They're dealing with injuries.
And this year's going to be twice as hard. If you look how the star teams have beefed up.
Yeah.
Broncos, Pats, Seattle's looking just as good. I mean,
and the Bears have added a lot. I mean, teams are starting to load up and really make a push to beat the Niners, who are seemingly on the top year after year. And in my mind,
ticking.
Exactly. The Niners need to get it done soon, or else they're not going to be able to pay all this money for Kaepernick, Willis, Smith, guys who they need to keep on this roster to keep them going to NFC champions and two Super Bowls. And I think
couldn't have said it better.
So, I mean, it's going to be huge to see what they do in response to both the Culliver and Kaepernick real incidents. We're going to have to see what happens because the draft is coming up soon, and NFL season is going to start playing no matter if Kaepernick's in jail or if Culliver's in jail or not.
Oh,
so
goodness.
The Niners need to start making their moves and start really implementing themselves as that top two team in the NFC.
And if you're going to do that, you got to hold yourself to a high standard on the field and off the field. And it's kind of shown some immaturity from Cap, and he's a young player, but no excuses. And I'm not going to give one lick of an excuse for Culliver, because that guy is just kind of put a bullseye on his back ever since the Super Bowl and the homosexuality remarks he kind of did himself in with that. So Niners got themselves some issues to resolve.
Kind of streaming off that in real, not let's go to a lighter subject. I haven't really heard too much about the Niners mock drafts or anything about who they plan to pick, because I've just been focusing on the Raiders at number 5. The Niners pick way deeper in the draft, so you don't get to hear too much about them. Who do you think is a real candidate for the Niners to draft in that first round?
I think if the Niners stay at home where they're at right now, I think you're going to see them look at 3 players. If these players are available, one being Jason Verrett, corner from TCU, wide receiver Brandon Cooks from Oregon State.
Yeah, he's good.
Possibly Bradley Roby from Ohio State, another corner.
Do you see them trading up?
This is where I think that they can play the draft as aggressively as they want. And if you want a corner, you're going to have to go up and you're going to have to trade up. That's if you want Denard, if you want Gilbert, you got to trade up, point blank. I don't even know if Verrett's going to be there. I think he will, just because people are saying he's undersized, which you see undersized corner ball in the NFL. So I hate when scouts get into that. That could be a gem there. But I think if they want to get a really solid piece, you trade up.
And they have the picks to do it.
They do.
They have the ability to trade up and get that star player that you're talking about. Now, I don't know if they go in the top 5. That might be a little too far for them. But a mid-range 10 to 12 pick.
Yeah, if they get around 15 or something, I don't know who they'd go after, because there's a lot of speculation of this Mike Evans.
Yeah.
Potentially. I don't know if he's a great fit. I don't think they go there. I think they'd look at a corner. And
I think
as a fan, I'd go Gilbert.
I think they need a corner due to the free agency. They've lost two of their starting cornerbacks.
Yeah.
Both going to Oaktown, and they've lost Whitner in the past year. I mean, things have happened to where this Niner defense, that which was once feared, they need to start getting those young players in to really learn from the guys like Patrick Willis and other leaders on the defensive side. So I see them possibly trading up, but then if they don't, I think that, like you said, they have all the power to do what they want in this draft. Yeah. If they want to wait back and they think they're going to get the player that they want, then that's what they'll do.
If the draft is panning out like they can do that, I think they will. As Roldan and Castro just hopped in the studio, but we'll see how they play it out. You're listening to Temple of Swan on radio.dominica.edu. We got Jade Castro and Noel Roldan here next.
We are back at the Temple of Swan. We have female basketball players Jade Castro and Noel Roldan joining us. How are you guys feeling on this sunny day?
Hey, you guys. How's it going? I'm feeling great. Jade, how are you?
I'm good.
See, Noel's no stranger to this. She has, not at all. She's had her own show. She's on mostly anything that's being broadcasted here, so she'll be probably better than us on the mic. Now, Noel, you're a senior. You're getting close to graduation. How excited are you to really be done with the academic part of Dominican?
Oh my God, how excited am I? Like on a scale of 1 to 10, like a 15.
Okay. Oh,
so nice. They make it so hard to graduate though. It's ridiculous. Like,
quick lay down, what's it like?
You know, well, they don't want you here, and then they don't want you to leave. And it's like the hardest thing ever. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's just frustrating because there's always that one credit that there's something wrong with it, or, you know, the designation on this one class, you signed up for the wrong one, you have to get it switched. But the way that you get it switched is you have to do an academic petition and then like all these signatures. So it's definitely a frustrating process, and it's like nerve-wracking because God forbid something goes wrong and you get to the last week and you're like, okay, I'm all set to graduate, and all of a sudden you get a letter from the registrar's office and they're like, yeah, by the way,
WTF.
Yeah, you know.
That's what they'll say.
That's exactly what I'll say.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit stressful, but it's been nice. It's been interesting being just a student, not a student athlete.
All right. So, Jade, this was your freshman year, right?
Yes.
Playing ball. Roldan was a senior. How was it playing together, and what did you learn from Noelle throughout the season?
It was definitely cool because she was like a mentor to me. She's like a big sister, so I got to like look up to her. Playing with her was really fun and exciting too because she had so much energy on the court and she brought so much energy to our team. So when she graduates, I definitely want to carry that on because we kind of somewhat have the same personality, so hopefully it works out.
She's so sweet. She's so sweet. Stab it.
Cash is going to be filling the Roldan role on the team. I can see it. I can see it.
No, we're definitely a lot alike when it comes to the type of energy that we bring to the court. And we just want to have a lot of fun when we're out there. We don't want to lose sight of why we're out there. And so it was nice to have a freshman that I could joke with and have fun with, but also know that she's going to get down to business on the court with me. And you don't usually get that because as a senior or even as a junior, you have to be like really stone-faced, really serious. Otherwise, your players won't follow suit. And yeah. So it was nice to be able to have that balance because I enjoy basketball and I love basketball. And every time I'm on the court, I'm having a good time. So it was just nice to have that type of teammate.
And they're going to lose your big leadership. They're going to lose Quaywon Owens and Cox. Who can fill in? Who's going to step up? And are there any recruits coming in that could help?
No one. Not at all. They're completely screwed.
It's not looking right for the
team. They're completely lost without us. No. There's going to – I think that next year the team dynamics are going to be a lot different. You know, Danielle Yamauchi and Lauren Hyatt were a couple of the captains this year. They were juniors last year, and so that, I mean, obviously as seniors they're going to be leaders as well, but their type of leadership was also quiet leadership and role model leadership, which is nothing wrong with it, but sometimes when it comes to being the enforcer and being the loudmouth and the one who's really going to put their foot down, that's the type of leadership that they're losing, and that's the type of leadership that they need. So hopefully someone will step up. I know that there's a few people on the team that have the capability. But it's also a fine line because, you know, Jasmine Cox was our enforcer on our team, but she did it in a way of like people respected her. So she could drop the hammer on you, but you had to respect her just because you knew where it was coming from. And that's going to be the key, I think, for next year's team, is finding somebody who's going to be able to step into that leadership role, but also gain the respect and not step on toes.
It's tough to do.
Yes, it is.
You have any input on that, Cash? Are you agreed? Wholeheartedly, because I think
definitely agree, but I mean, spring workouts it's really been different without them. But our new player, she was a redshirt last year. Her name is Kelsey. She's definitely stepped up to the plate, and she knows that, I guess, since the seniors are leaving, that she should step up. So it's been really cool to see someone new come in and take over the leadership role.
Now, going back to last season, you made it to the first round of the conference tournament, had a tough loss. What were your feelings overall on the season, both of you, and how it played out?
Jade, you can go first.
Well, I mean, it was my freshman season. It was a really good experience for me, definitely, because I know this year we did a lot better than we've been doing for the past couple of years. It feels good to, like, turn the season around from going 0-12 into actually doing really good in the season. And, yeah, so it was pretty cool. It was a really good experience and really good season to start off with.
For me, I have to say that last season is a little bit bittersweet, more bitter than sweet.
Yeah.
It was my last season, and so, of course, all I wanted to do was win. And the good things that I could take away from last season is, just like Jade said, we started off horrible. We had one of the worst records. I've never thought that we could play such horrible basketball, and we literally turned it around. Almost complete 180, and I think the only teams that we really weren't able to knock out were APU and and Point Loma. And so that's some positives to take away from it. It was really bitter at the end there because we should have won that game at the end.
We were listening. What happened on that last play to send it into OT?
We should have called a timeout. What should have happened was we should have called a timeout.
Okay.
And a lot of us on the bench were screaming, call a timeout, call a timeout. Melissa Boscarino had the ball out of bounds and had no idea what to do with it. And sometimes, you know, we found ourselves in situations that we weren't used to being in, and that comes with lack of experience, and that also comes with just certain people didn't really play a lot, and then they all of a sudden getting thrown in the fire. Yeah. At the very That's last tough. Game, it's hard for them to think on their toes. So can you put all the blame on somebody? No, you can't. Yeah. It's a full game. We all made mistakes, and it's unfortunate, but yeah, that last play, we fought back from like a 14-point lead.
Yeah, you got the lead.
We chipped away. We finally got it. Everybody was just meshing, and that last play really just changed the entire momentum for overtime, and it was like all of our energy and everything that we had going towards the finish line just kind of just went out. We were done, and it was really unfortunate, and that's probably why I am so bitter about that last game, because we've never been closer. We were literally right there, and I had a feeling that we were going to upset Academy of Art in that next round.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah, we would have.
We were stoked. We were jumping up, looking like a bunch of maniacs.
We would have. I'm sorry, but we would have smashed Academy of Art next round. And not because we're better than them, but just because they think that they're better than everyone else, and they would have overlooked us. They would have overlooked us. Yeah.
So what do you think? Now, we know there's no Coach Chambers, and we're not going to get into the juicy details, but how does this team respond to a new coach now? You think it's positive?
I think that there's the opportunity for this team to respond positively, and I think that the pieces that are left for a new coach are so well put together that he or she won't have to do a lot of work to make this a winning program, and he doesn't have to start from the ground up, which is such a good situation coming in for a new coach. And I think the only situation that I've noticed with the players having a new coach is a lot of players are worried, as they should be. It's a business. It's a cutthroat business. Athletes are hung out to dry, and that's the dirty truth of the whole NCAA, is that all we are pawns, and at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, and there's a thousand more just like you that are willing to take your spot. And so that's why I think that the players are a little bit worried, because, you know, who's to say that a new coach isn't going to come in and take their just give somebody else their new spot? But what I've noticed is that Brandon Leinbach, the athletic director, has been super supportive and has given the ladies so many chances to sit down and actually talk to the coaches that are willing to come in and just get a measure of their type of character and who they are as a coach, and feel comfortable with a new coach coming in, which is great, because that's just only going to build trust for whoever they choose.
Yeah, what's that process been like for you, Castro, because you've been having to go through as a freshman?
I mean, when I first heard about it, it was pretty hard to take in. But right now, I mean, since our team has been working out together lately, we've definitely come together, and we've definitely become stronger. And it makes us feel a lot better and more confident, knowing that we do have a say, at least a little say, in who our coach will be next year, so that we're not left out to dry. So,
what kind of coach does this team need, compared to what Chambers couldn't get it done with you guys? What?
Ooh, that's a good question, Alex.
I'm just wondering.
I think that this coach needs. Can I say ass on the radio?
Oh yeah, go for definitely. I already dropped that earlier today. Dominican
needs a women's basketball coach that's going to kick ass, and that's going to come in one way and stay one way. I think that.
Coach Chambers was too wishy-washy.
Coach Chambers, and wishy-washy has too negative of a connotation, because I'm not going to step on anyone's toes and disrespect anybody. But what I do want to say is that when it comes to basketball, or when it comes to coaching any sport, you have to be consistent in your coaching, in the way that you coach. And unfortunately for Coach Chambers, she tried too many different ways to get to us. So she would be really, really nice just like kind of really nice to try to get us to play, or she'd be really, really mean. And for me, I've played with the nicest coaches in the world, and I've played for the meanest coaches in the world. But what I respect about them is that they always stay nice and they always stay mean. And whenever you have a chance to get like throw it back in the coach's face, like, well, that's different because you didn't get mad about that yesterday because yesterday you were being nice.
That's got to confuse
you. Yeah, you know, too. It is. It's tough. And so that's why I think that sometimes with Coach Chambers, she had some problems with players because players didn't know how to, like, for me, I'm like a blind soldier. That's how I was raised. That's how I was coached growing up. So you're my coach, you do what you want to do, and I just follow blindly because at the end of the day, like, you're my captain basically, and I just follow suit. Yeah. And so if you want to be nice, if you want to be mean, that's fine. I don't really care what it is, but I know what you need and I know what you want at the end of the day. But with new generations of players coming in, you can't be like that. Especially with, I'm sorry, but new players are sissies.
Really?
Little kids.
Like they can't hack the
younger
lifestyle?
Kids, the younger kids. Can't hack the lifestyle. The younger kids that I get, that I see these days, they're like, man, they cry a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you have to sometimes be like, come on? Like,
yeah. I think a lot of it, I mean, I think, and I don't mean it when I talk about Jade, because Jade had a coach.
Jade's a scrappy player.
Yeah, Jade had a coach that was like in her ass all the time. But one thing with me was I noticed that a lot of players, they have a hard time with criticism and they have a hard time being told that they can't do something. And they also have an even harder time putting in the work to show someone that they can do something. And I think that a lot of it has to do with high school sports is ruining college basketball.
Ooh.
And it's because it's more important to win games than it is to actually coach the fundamentals of basketball and to actually create basketball players, basketball minded players, because anybody can get get a 6'4" Sarah Nelson in high school and just have her shoot the ball over and over again.
Yeah.
Well, you're 6'4". So every other person in your league is probably 5'6". So of course you're just going to give it to her every single time in the middle. Of course you're just going to have her stand in the key and block shots. Like, that's easy. But what's hard is to teach her footwork and to teach her basketball IQ and to all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely.
And that's why I feel like high school basketball is like ruining NCAA sports.
I would love to see you as a coach. We'll see. Well, we know these ladies do have to get going. It is 6:15. They got open gym going on and got some nightlife plans ahead of them. But
I'm a retired NCAA athlete. I can go out if I want to.
Oh, definitely. We thank you, ladies, for stopping by.
Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah, that was
a
good interview in only 15 minutes.
Yes.
Yeah. Much better than one of those longer ones that we haven't gotten too much information on. So thank you, Jade. Thank you, Noelle. And go have a good open gym.
Yeah, thanks, awesome. Guys.
Thank you.
All right.
And we'll be back at templeofswanradio.dominican.edu.
No doubt. Love them all.
Bye.
That Cupid sort of man.
We are back at the Temple of Swan Radio. Dominican.edu. That was a great interview with Noel Roldan and Jade Castro. Just wish it could have gone a little bit longer, but of course they have to get to their open gym priorities and make sure they're getting their work in.
Yeah, can't fault them for that.
But we are going to talk some basketball of our own. This having to be with the Golden State Warriors, 48-29.
Dubs.
That scared me, guys. But yes, the Dubs are one win away from clinching a berth in the playoffs for consecutive years, and they are going against the Denver Nuggets tonight on TNT, I believe.
TNT.
It's a nationally broadcast game. I know that for sure, so make sure you check that out. And the magic number is one. Do they get it done tonight, Swanee?
Yes. Nuggets have been playing well as of late. I don't think they spoil the clincher for the Warriors. I think Dubs get it done, and I just want to give a little couple claps for that coaching staff and the players. What they dealt, when we started the conversation in the beginning, the Warriors started out okay. They hit that big 10 to 12 game win streak. I can't remember exactly what it was, and then it dipped down. They had a little problem, and then boom, they're right here trying to clinch up at number six, and this is a battle-tested West. So I think this is a team that, I'll say, if healthy, they can make a deep run, but even if they don't have Lee or are complete healthy, we could see another spectacular performance from Harrison Barnes or whoever needs to step up.
Yeah, the main thing about the West is just getting in the playoffs and then letting it pan out from there. The West is 1-8, pretty deep, so you know there's going to be tightly contested battles in that first round, and like you said, every team is going to be battle-tested, and anyone could pull out victorious in what seems to be the deepest conference race probably in the last 10 years.
Really? I can't remember, except maybe when the 8th seed Memphis took out the number 1 San Antonio. That was a pretty deep Western Conference, but this is extremely deep. I agree. In the last decade, this has been up at the top. And
yeah,
it's just a...
Sorry, I cut you off. But don't get me wrong. The Spurs and the Thunder are in a class of their own, but we're saying that they could possibly get beaten in that first round because of how good the Mavericks are, how good the Suns are, how good the Warriors are. There's, like we said, so many good teams, but like I still like the Spurs, I still like the Thunder, but anything could happen in this Western Conference.
I agree, and I think this is a series of where home court is critical because these games could be going seven, and that's where OKC and San Antonio have that advantage down the stretch. And it's going to come up if they end up facing each other in the Western Conference Finals. I don't think that will be the case, though. I think this playoff bracket might get a little jumbled up. But if they do, I don't know. San Antonio hasn't had success against OKC, but
they got swept in the season series.
They have a home court advantage, and I feel like that seventh game now is just becoming key.
Yeah.
And so I can't wait. Road will be huge because a lot of these teams in the West can play at home.
Yeah.
They can take care of business regardless who it is.
And getting back to the Warriors, who are 48-29, 19 games over 500. They've had a little turmoil within their front office. Two assistant coaches have been fired and hosed.
Oh, my goodness.
Only leaving three left. You don't really know what's happening behind the scenes. But what we're seeing on the court and the players' responses to Mark Jackson, it's a tight-knit group. Everyone loves Mark Jackson. Draymond Green, Curry, Thompson, Bogut, they're all playing hard for Coach Mark Jackson, and they want him to stay around. And I think that's all that really matters. If the players like you, then you should be the coach of this team.
The players produce on the floor. They get you the results. And if those players play their tails off for their coaches, why would you want to go anywhere else? Yes, it comes down to schemes. It comes down to X's and O's. It comes down to coaches' leadership and philosophy. But if the players play hard for their coach, you can't ask more than that.
Yeah.
Sometimes, yes, you have the Hall of Fame coaches. Tip your cap to them. Not every team's going to have a Hall of Fame coach like Popovich or like... I'm just going to leave it at Popovich right now.
Yeah.
But Mark Jackson's doing a great job. And despite all the behind-the-scenes wreckage, this team can do damage in the playoffs. And I'm saying, even without David Lee, don't count him out.
Yeah, and what we've really seen without David Lee, they got Bogut back for the last game. What we've seen without David Lee is this starting five might even be better without him. They have Draymond Green playing some of his best ball he's ever played. Then they have Bogut at the five, and you have Iguodala and Thompson, two of the best defenders on the wing, and then you got Curry. Very good starting five, even without David Lee. And it gives him some more flexibility.
Green's a better defender than Lee.
Yeah.
Hands down.
And he rebounds way better.
Yes. And so I'm going to make a weird analogy because I don't want to compare the Penguins to the Warriors, but this is kind of what we saw with Golston going down. I mean, Lee isn't the best player on the Warriors, but Golston goes down, Penguins get a little bit better. They start playing better. Lee goes down, oh crap, Warriors start to elevate their play a little bit. So yeah. I don't know.
And we've noticed that Draymond Green also brings a kind of energy that we haven't seen from David Lee. Draymond Green will take that technical. He'll get in someone's face to fire up his team.
That's what you need.
David Lee doesn't do that. He's more of the quiet scorer. The guy just gives him the ball and he'll force up his shot. What we've seen with Draymond Green in the starting lineup has changed the Warriors, and that's why they've gone 7-3 in their last 10, just one game away from clinching a spot in the playoffs. I mean, they could go anywhere from 5-8. Right now, it looks like they will be in that sixth seed taking off against the Clippers. What are your feelings in an L.A. Clipper, Golden State Warriors first-round matchup?
I was really worried about this matchup 2 weeks ago, but now Jamal Crawford will not play in the playoffs. He is essentially done. He's a huge player off the bench.
Yeah, and he's a scorer off the bench for that second
electric
unit.
Electric. J.J. Redick, yes, he is back. Darren Collison playing good off the bench. This is a bitter, bitter rivalry, and so this is where you can kind of almost throw, I've been talking about so much about home court, you can almost throw it out because these teams are going to get after it. And you know what? Sometimes when you say they hypothetically say they make it into the fifth and they play Houston in the first round. On paper, yeah, that looks a lot better. Howard's been injured and such. But when you play a team that's your rivalry and they might be slightly better than you, you're going to elevate your play.
Exactly. And I think there's no other first round possibility matchup that is more intriguing than a Clippers Warriors. Maybe a
Absolutely.
Thunder
That's
Warriors.
A fan dream.
But I think Clippers Warriors, because of the rivalry, because Mark Jackson, Absolutely. Blake Griffin feuds, Bogut will get into it, you're pretty sure. That first round matchup will demand attention.
Hands down.
And it will get the primetime games in almost every slot. So I feel like a Warriors-Clippers matchup will go back and forth. It will go to seven games, and we'll see who wins that battle. But that's the matchup that I think everyone wants to see, and me being a fan that I want to see.
I agree. I don't think any NBA fan would disagree with you at all. And no one would disagree with you that that's the number one intrigued matchup, not only in the Western Conference playoffs, but of all the playoffs. That's going to be opening round. And you know what? That whoever comes out of that is battle tested and they just beat one heck of a team.
Yeah.
And so
they're gonna have to earn it.
Yeah, who knows what can happen in the second round out of who emerges there. But Dubs can play with the Clips. I'm not worried at all. Before we get to the East, I just want to ask you, who gets left out of this? Because we got Memphis knocking on the door right here. Who gets left out?
So there's four teams who are really still within the hunt that haven't clinched yet. You have the Warriors, Mavericks, Suns, and then Memphis, who's at that nine slot on the outside looking in, only one game back. And my opinion on this is that Memphis really is just a little too late in their second half surge, and I think the Suns will close the door on that eighth seed. They are 8-2 in their last 10. They've won three straight. The Mavericks have won four straight, gone 7-3 in their last 10, and I think the Mavericks are just one game short, and I think they'll stay in that ninth seed. How about you?
I agree with you. I think Memphis is going to get cut short. If there's a tiebreaker here, I don't know who owns it between Phoenix and Memphis, but I thought prior that Phoenix was going to get dumped out and they weren't going to make it. And I honestly think Memphis is a better matchup against San Antonio because they play that lockdown defense. They can bang with San Antonio, and I don't know, Phoenix just doesn't seem, you shut down Goran Dragic and Eric Bledsoe and they are a whole new ball club, but we'll see what happens. Hats off to Jeff Hornacek, who's been coaching his
tail
off.
Yeah, he's probably going to be coach of the year.
To lead them at the ACD. Okay, now on to the East. And another thing, if you're a fan, you pretty much throw out all the first-round matchups in the East. You might not even catch a couple. You may catch a couple games of each series, but you may not. It's going to be focused on the West. But Indiana's got a half game.
And they're slumping.
On Miami.
They're slumping.
Both teams are slumping. Miami's a huge different story when Wade is playing. But it doesn't look like any of these teams are going to challenge Miami and Indiana. It looks like a little bit of a collision course meeting into the Eastern Conference Finals. They get their kind of a cakewalk. They battle it out. Winner goes to the ship. I hate that.
Yeah, and I feel the same way. I think the only real sleeper team, if you can call them that, in the East is that winner between the Chicago-Brooklyn matchup.
A rematch.
Because those will be two teams that have the kind of star power that can get it done maybe against the top teams like the Pacers and Heat. But like you said, even though the Pacers and Heat are slumping late in the season, they're really just focused on the playoffs. I think those teams are on a collision course to play each other in the Eastern Conference Finals.
I agree. Which is one thing that sticks out, what you just made. Brooklyn, undefeated against the Heat.
Yeah.
This season.
And they swept the season series. The only team to do that against LeBron James in his career.
So, and one reporter asked LeBron, is Brooklyn your biggest concern? And LeBron just said, absolutely not. You're crazy. Next question.
Yeah.
Indiana is obviously their concern, but look out.
Yeah. And I think both Brooklyn and the Bulls are playing well enough of late to get hot going into the playoffs, as we are down to that final stretch. So I think those are the two teams that are kind of the hidden competition that the Pacers and Heat will have. But those first round matchups look to be Indiana versus the Hawks, who are 35-43, then the Heat versus the Wizards, who are 40-38. Those don't seem to be...
Could be a double sweep.
Yeah, too much of a challenge for either team. And then you have even the Bobcats making the playoffs at 40-38. Who would have saw that? But the East is kind of a mess. Does look like a collision course between the two top teams.
But that Chicago-Brooklyn, that's going to be a great series.
Yeah.
Dude, Chicago just, they're that Energizer Bunny team that will grind on you until you just fall down.
You don't want to get into a 6 or 7 game series against the Bulls because they have the horses to where they like that style of play. Yeah. They like that bruise them, play that slow-paced game. And if you get into a series like, let's say Miami has to go against Chicago,
and they have
to deal through a 7-game series against them.
And yeah, Miami might get by, but they'll be battered.
Exactly. And then the next round against the Pacers, you're not going to be ready to run that up-and-gun game against them, who are also another very good defensive team.
Pacers need to get it going. We're looking at their team right now. 34-6 at home, 20-19 on the road.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Those are some bad road numbers.
That's struggle city on the road for the Pacers. And this was a team that we talked about 2 months ago, month and a half ago, that they were the favorite to win the title. They were playing better than the Spurs, better than the Thunder, not nearly as much anymore. I think I'm thinking both of us are in agreement that the champion's coming from the West.
I feel that way. I mean, if the Heat get into the championship series, then
I don't think they get it.
Then you don't think they exactly, but that's the only time, because I didn't think they'd win it last year either. Yeah. But they have LeBron, they have Wade, they have Bosch.
It's dangerous. Yeah, it's dangerous if they get in because you don't know
what's going to happen.
It's capable for Mr. James. I'm done doubting him, but I'll throw out another wild fan craze prediction.
Okay, what's that?
No, shit for the Heat. It's not craze, but
okay. I thought you were going to say something like the Bobcats.
Raptors won it all.
The Bobcats are going to run the table. That's what I thought. But yeah, I mean, like I don't see it happening either. I think the winner does come out of the West. Those have been the top teams. They've been consistently playing well throughout the season. San Antonio, again, looks to be dangerous. They're probably the most complete team in this playoff bracket. So we'll have to see what happens coming down the final stretch. But Warriors are one game away from making that playoff dream come true. Just one win tonight against the Nuggets. We'll get it done.
Give me a team that will win it all.
Team that will win
it
all.
Just throw one out there.
I'm going to go with the Spurs. I like the way the Spurs play, and I think they are 10 deep.
They are.
Pop has those guys running well, and I think they're just a all-round great team. How about you?
That's a good pick.
Who do you think wins it?
I'm going to say it's Durant's year. Somehow he gets it done. Spurs are a better team up top to bottom. They got 10 deep, like you said. I'm gonna throw out the OKC. I would not mind seeing San Antonio get that title, though. They deserved it last year.
Yeah.
To get back.
As long as it's not the Heat, I feel...
Yeah.
As long as it's not the Heat, then I'm a happy camper.
Yeah, me too. I think a lot of fans are going to feel that way, but if Bron goes three-peat... My goodness!
My goodness.
All right. That's going to wrap up our show at the Temple of Swan. You got any last words, Mr. Temple?
It's been nice doing business with you on the show.
Yeah.
This week.
Another good show in the books. In the books! See you later, ladies and gentlemen. This is Temple of Swan on radio.dominican.edu. Keep it classy.